Adobe Express is the quick and easy create anything app. It's my go-to for making my business stand out. From videos and social posts to flyers and logos. Search for Adobe Express to find out more and use it for free.
Hello and welcome back to Immigrantly 2025. Yes, we are back with a bang. I am your host, Sadia Khan. Now, December usually makes me nervous. I've talked about it on my show. The chaos, the reflections, the looming deadlines. But you know what? January calms me down. It's like the universe's collective exhale. The beginning of the year eases me into a rhythm filled with hopes, dreams, aspirations, and ambitions. And I'm here for all of it. I've been spending time with my family, listening to some songs, and cuddling with my kitten, Sheru. Talking about songs, so I have a few thoughts about a song that I've recently been obsessed with, but also critical of. And I'm sure a lot of you already know about this song, and some may not. It's Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire. Harry Truman, Doris, yeah, this one. China, Johnny Ray, South Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe. It's a bop, but I wanted to talk about how it just lists history like chaotic, grossly list. No critique, no deep dives, just here's some stuff that happened. And that we didn't start the fire, that line, it just feels like somebody is saying, well, they are saying, not my problem. Now look, history is messy, and this song makes it sound like a highlight reel without asking why those fires kept burning. And I was like, let me ask my listeners, what are their thoughts? What do you think? Write to me. This song really stuck with me, and I thought I'll share with all of you and see if you felt the same way when you listened to it. If you haven't, then listen to it and tell me what your thoughts are. But anyways, now to today's guest. You know what? This person really inspired me when I started listening to her podcast just last month. Anita Rao is the host and creator of Embodied, a podcast that dives headfirst into conversations that we are often too afraid to have.
The first time I learned about biological sex was a ninth grade science class. And my early takeaway was that it comes down to genetics. Either you have XX chromosomes and you're biologically female, or XY chromosomes and you're biologically male.
Think intimacy. And while that first body image, relationships, theory, as soon as I sex, out of the classroom, and everything in between. She's a trailblazer who's turning silence into dialogue and discomfort into connection. So let's jump into an unfiltered, thoughtful, and downright fascinating conversation. Welcome to Immigrantly, Anita. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been listening to your podcast. By the way, I discovered it randomly. I am a huge podcast listener. and I browse through Apple Podcasts, like browse page, which is crazy because I came across Embodied and I was like, let me listen to this one. It was so much fun.
Aww.
And what was fascinating to me was the number of episodes you've done and the depth and breadth of topics that you've covered. Just by looking at the titles, I was blown away. How are you feeling about where you are in this podcast journey?
What a good question to ask at the start of a new year. The interesting thing about Embodied is that it has gone through a couple of different evolutions. It started as a series. I worked for a statewide daily talk show, had the opportunity to guest host occasionally when the host started to go on longer trips. He was kind of phasing into retirement. And there was a whole summer that I had the opportunity to host for 4 weeks in a row. And Embodied started just as kind of a trial experience that summer as to like, let's see what it's like to talk about these topics on the radio. I studied women's studies in college. I have always gravitated toward content that explores the intersection of bodies and identity and relationships. So it was a series on a talk show. Then it kind of spun into a podcast. Now it's a radio show. So in every iteration, it's kind of felt like starting again in some ways. So while I've been doing it since 2019 in some form, each version of it has felt a little bit new and different. We started as a standalone radio show January 2021. So it'll be, I guess we're entering our like fourth full year as a radio show. And it's hard to say how I feel about where I am in my journey, because as I said, it feels like it's been kind of small steps. Like I never thought that I would be here at this point where it's a national radio show and our audience is really different. But I think from an audience perspective, I guess that's the thing that's shifted the most for me. Creating something for like people like me, I think was how I first started, was like, I'm curious about this. And I think there are other people out there who are. And now I know the audience is primarily a public radio listening audience, which is like older and whiter. And holding that in my brain means having to approach things slightly differently or just be considerate of like what's the starting point everyone has for coming into the conversation. So I'm at a point in my journey where I'm thinking a lot about who's listening and how they're receiving the information and how to be authentically myself and tell the stories I want to tell while also meeting the audience where they are.
Were there times when you held back because of the audience that you have, when you were like, I don't know if I should be sharing this the way or framing it the way I want to frame because the audience will not get it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think from a topic perspective, I feel a lot of freedom to mostly talk about the topics that I want to talk about. But I think there are moments within an interview with a guest where I have a moment of hesitation about should I go there or should I not go there. So there was a recent interview for an episode we're doing that's coming out about what it's like to be an OnlyFans creator. And I was talking to the woman and talking about the process of creating. And she started to tell some stories about how she responds to people that troll her and are like really rude to her. And as she started to tell that story, I knew pretty quickly, like, this can't make it to the air. Like, or for this to make it to the air, I'm going to have to really like approach this exchange in a very particular way. And I don't think that's going to be interesting. So I'm just going to let you finish your story and assume we're going to cut it. So there are moments where I'm like, oh, I wish I could go there and I wish we could dig into this dynamic, but I know that it won't work. So I have to just like stop while we're ahead.
I'm curious to know what kind of internal conversation you have as a creative when that happens. Like, how disappointed are you?
It depends on the moment. I think in that moment, I was thinking like the story that she's about to tell is the story that I know would be the first thing I would tell my friends about after this interview, which in some ways makes me be like, I should ask it. Like, yes. That means it's the most compelling thing. So in those moments, I'm like, oh, I'm bummed. Like, I wish this didn't have to be the case. But other times it feels, other times I can like see, the way we record our interviews, I can see into the booth, like where the producers and editors are. So sometimes it's easier for me to look up, and we kind of have this moment where I'm like, okay. I can like let it go faster. So it depends on how like personally invested I feel in that moment of the conversation.
Anita, I want to pivot to your personal life. You identify as a third culture kid. You did a whole episode on it. And in your opinion, what are some of the differences between second gen kids of immigrants and third culture kids?
That's a really good question and something I grappled with a lot in the episode, because I think my definition of a third culture kid changed in some ways as we were recording that episode, because I saw myself in some of the stories of the people I talked to, but I also didn't in others. I think for me, the difference comes, well, I guess, I mean, to be totally honest, I'm not sure that I have a great answer for this. I think what's interesting in my particular situation is I am technically a first-generation immigrant, but I identify as a second-generation immigrant. Like, I grew up, or I was, like, technically born abroad. I spent the first third of my life, not the first third, the first 3 years of my life in India and England, but all of my formative memories are in the United States. I think in that way, I relate a lot to second gen kids, where like the building of my identity is in the culture, is in U.S. culture, and my parents' identities are in different cultures. I think because my parents are each from a different country and have very distinct upbringings, that third culture-ness resonates for me, where I feel like there is a British culture, there's an Indian culture, and then there's an American culture. And like, it's not just, oh, I have Indian parents and they do this thing this way. It's like I'm at this intersection of multiple different ones. So it's almost like being a mixed kid and being a third culture kid, I feel like have a lot of similarities that maybe being a second gen kid, there's a distinction there.
You know, I watched the reel that you put on your Instagram where your mom is making chicken curry. And yes! I was like, oh my gosh, what a beautiful sight. Although being a Pakistani immigrant, I get turned off by the term chicken curry because I'm like, in India and Pakistan, there's no such thing as chicken curry, right? But I get it. And as you pointed out, both your parents are immigrants, but they are different kinds of immigrants, right? Your mom is a white immigrant. Your dad is an Indian immigrant. For you, as a mixed race kid, was there a time when you saw your parents' immigrant experiences differently, because your mom appears as this white British immigrant in the US while your dad doesn't? Were there any moments when you could see those differences play out in the outside environment?
What's so interesting about that is my mom is often actually read as Indian, because I think people assume she has a very strange accent that comes from being a British woman who married an Indian man when she was so young and then raised her kids mostly in the US. So her accent is confusing to people. I think people read her as like a North Indian woman who is like a lighter skinned Indian woman. She wears Indian clothes well. So it's funny you say that, because I think out in public, a lot of people are surprised when I tell them my mom is not Indian.
Ah, interesting.
Which is always shocking to me, because she's very distinct from my dad in my brain, in my mind. I think the time of my life where it has felt so the most stark, I guess, is when my parents moved to the South. When I graduated college, they moved from Iowa, where we had grown up and lived most of our lives, to Augusta, Georgia. And they moved into a neighborhood that they had next door neighbors who basically approached them and we're like, we just want you all to know that Augusta is very Southern. It's very much the South. And just be aware of like how you might be read as a mixed race couple here. And that was very shocking to them and very shocking for me to hear as their daughter. And I think that was the first time, like, I feel like in Iowa City where we grew up, it was like a college town. We were very involved in the Indian community. Like, I felt like we were kind of like accepted and read as like an Indian fusion family. But I think when they kind of went on their own and made this move later in their life and tried to get reestablished in a new place, like there's been a lot of cultural clash and discomfort and identity challenges for them in the South that didn't exist to my knowledge as a younger kid. So I feel like in watching them navigate that transition, I've become really aware of their different experiences. In some ways, it's that like the Indian community there is very insular and has not really welcomed them, potentially in part because they're mixed race. I don't know, but I know that you know, can happen in insular Indian communities. So they haven't really found their people there. And I think watching them each navigate that has shown me the different ways they experience their race and identity in the U.S., especially in the South.
Have you ever had a conversation about race with your parents?
For embodied. So honestly, like the most I have talked to my parents about a lot of topics related to identity is with microphones in front of us. And we did a whole episode about mixed race adulthood and growing up mixed race. And I talked to them for that episode. And it was really interesting because I was kind of putting questions to them about how they made choices around what they exposed us to and what they didn't, and how they thought about their identity. And I think like a lot of immigrants of their generation, of their age, like they were walking this fine line between feeling the need to assimilate out of necessity and wanting to preserve ties to where they came from. So I think like inside the home, you know, we were cooking Indian food. My dad was very invested in us understanding Hinduism and growing up in Hindu culture. But we weren't talking explicitly about race. And I don't think that they have said to me they don't feel like they really had the language or the ability to have those conversations. And now they're beginning to build that language and just didn't read a lot of their experiences through that lens at that time. Probably, I would say in part, like because of survival instincts. But I think now as I'm an adult and I'm inviting them into these conversations through the show, we have started to talk more about race and talk more about identity. But it's been only within the past like 5 years.
Honestly, I can relate to that because as immigrants, we don't think about race. Countries that we come from mostly, race is not the overarching conversation or topic that people are engaged with or in. America just puts you in a place where you don't have an option but to talk about race. I've talked about this on a lot of my episodes where it's like my Muslim identity was never part of my consciousness. It was one of the many identities, but I never thought of it. I never sat with it. And then I came to the U.S. and that's what everybody else started talking about. And
yes,
I was like, fuck, am I supposed to talk about my Muslimness now? And in what ways? And how do I frame those conversations, right? So to all the immigrants out there, I know it's not easy. We are not used to having these conversations. PSA for anyone who rents. If you haven't heard of Built, you are about to thank me. Earning points on rent is now a reality when you pay your rent through Built. You don't even have to check with your landlord to start earning points that you can use toward flights, hotel stays, fitness classes, and even your next rent payment. Let me break it down for you. There's no cost to join Built. And as a member, you'll earn valuable points on rent and on your everyday spending. Built points can be transferred to your favorite hotels and airlines, and even the ones you haven't heard of. There are over 500 airlines and 700,000 hotels and properties around the world you can redeem your built points towards. Points can also be redeemed towards a future rent payment and unique experiences that only Bilt members can access. How incredible is that? So, if you're not earning points on rent, my question is, why not? Start earning points on rent you're already paying by going to joinbilt.com/immigrantly. That's joinbilt.com/immigrantly. Make sure to use our URL so they know we sent you. joinbilt.com/immigrantly to start earning points on your rent payments today. I was listening to one of your podcast episodes where you talk about how your dad is a doctor. He is a gastroenterologist. And you guys talked about a lot of crazy stuff. But what stood out to me was most of those conversations were anatomical, right? It's like related to your body. But conversations that you wanted to have pertaining to relationships and sex and body positivity, those conversations were not happening because your mom grew up Catholic. Your dad is from India. How did you reconcile with that dichotomy of, oh, my dad can talk about poop, but he cannot talk about relationships?
It's something that I have really been unraveling as an adult. I think watching my parents interact with my niece and nephew has been so interesting in that realm where I can see how fluid and how much fluency they have in talking about the physical things of like pooping and peeing and learning about your body, but then kind of freezing up a little bit when there are those conversations that require a little bit more emotional language or emotional attunement, or having language to talk about feelings like that becomes more uncomfortable and unfamiliar. And so watching them interact with my niece and nephew has been a really interesting gateway into looking back at my own childhood. And you're right. Like it was, my mom was a midwife and then a labor and delivery nurse. And so anything related to the physical body was pretty much like open for discussion, open for conversation. We would like announce when we fart at the dinner table. Like, that's totally fine. It would always make my friends weirded out, but it became like something they all would joke about. I was thinking the other day, actually, I remember when I got my period and I was trying to learn, I was like, really could not make sense of how you insert a tampon. My mom demonstrated for me, like on herself in front of me. Like, I was in her bathroom and watched her do that. And so it was always like very open door policy in terms of like seeing my parents' bodies and asking questions about physical bodies, but such a big disconnect between that and then talking about anything related to like sensuality, sexuality, relationships. And I think a similar thing when I've asked my parents, they've said, like, we regret that. We feel like we didn't have the language or the tools, or I mean, I think a lot of ways they didn't feel comfortable, but maybe don't yet even have the language to say, like, we didn't feel comfortable doing that or having those conversations. But it's, I think a lot of my curiosity that has driven me to the show comes from that disconnect where I'm like, I am so comfortable and so familiar with a lot of things about the human body. All of my family are doctors. Like, the body feels very familiar to me. But how people feel about their body and interact with their body in a more, yeah, sensual, emotional way doesn't feel familiar. And I talk in therapy a lot about how I sometimes feel like I don't have the language. Like, I know that there's a thing that I want to express or that I'm thinking about, but I honestly don't even feel like I have the language to talk about that. Like, it wasn't taught to me. So part of my work on Embodied, I think, is like a healing journey for myself to develop that language and to bridge that divide between like these parts of the body that feel so known and these feelings about the body that feel very unknown to me.
So to me, as an immigrant who grew up in a different country, conversations around emotions are not as structured, right? If I am feeling something, I will express it through words, but then I would not intentionally think about how to articulate emotions. It's not something that I am aware of. It's something that I do organically, whether it's showing emotions towards my kids through physical acts that will make them comfortable or recognizing my own emotions. Do you think this idea of being expressive around your emotions is very American in some ways? And as immigrants or people who grew up in different countries, we are held to this standard, which may not be the norm for us. Have you ever thought about it through that lens with your parents?
Yes. There's an incredible book that I read in the last year called But What Will People Say? By Sahej Kaur Kohli. And she's the creator of Brown Girl Therapy. And reading that book, I almost wish someone had been filming me reading it, because like my head was so aggressively nodding the whole time. So I was like, this is like, you're writing my life story. And a lot of that book is about, yeah, I think her reckoning with the ways that she feels like she's supposed to talk about her emotions and the language she's developed as a therapist and the ways that she grew up. And it was really healing, honestly, to read that book and for me to think about like the difference between like the kind of therapy language terms and what we're actually trying to get to. And one of the examples she gives in the book is about boundaries and how this idea of boundaries is so common in Western culture. And everyone is talking about boundaries and using the word boundaries, but how that word just does not register in a lot of South Asian families.
It doesn't.
And that concept that you should be separating yourself from your parents at all is like, what are you even talking about? And so she kind of talks about how, yes, that word is not going to resonate, but is there a way that we can think about like what that concept is trying to get at? And is there a way to get at that with your family through a different doorway, through a different form of expression? So I think you're right. I think that this expectation that we all talk about our emotions in the way that some versions of Western culture say is like the right way to talk about emotions, I think that that's, you know, I think that that's like leaving a lot of people out and unnecessarily like shaming people's ways of processing things. But I do feel like what you're saying, to me, the gap that I've noticed in myself and my own family is I think we can, and my therapist actually gave me this language, like we know how to like discharge our emotions. So that might be like crying tears or
I like that.
Yelling at someone. Like that is like a discharge of like, I have this feeling and it's like bottling up inside and I'm going to discharge it, but I'm not actually feeling it. I'm not actually like working through the like arc of the emotion. And so that's what I have been thinking a lot about is like, maybe I don't need to necessarily have the words to be able to talk someone else through like every step of the arc of my emotion, but can I at least like learn how to feel that in my own body in a way that's not just like discharging it outward? Because my family are big criers. Like my mom is a crier. Like if she starts crying, then my sister starts crying, then I start crying. And so it's like we emote around each other, but we don't talk about why we're crying. And I think sometimes it's like, it's confusing for kids. Like if someone's crying, you don't know why. So I think as adults, it's like to be able to say like, I'm feeling so happy. It's bringing me to tears.
You're absolutely right. I think for me personally, I feel like verbalizing emotions of, oh, I'm happy, I'm sad, I love you, I resent you, I get stuck because I was not taught that, right? As you said, discharging those emotions is easy. If I'm angry, I will cry. If I'm happy, I can cry. But then saying that I am happy, it's so funny I have two daughters, and they know. They grew up in a South Asian household. They know that we don't say, I love you, every 5 seconds. But there are times when they will say things like, why don't you say that, right? And to me, I feel if I did, I would sound so performative.
Really?
Right? I would sound so fake
yeah,
and shallow.
Of course.
Because my mother, and I kid you not, I don't think she's ever said, I love you.
Yeah.
But I know she loves me, Anita. That's the irony. It's so ingrained in me. I don't want her to verbalize it.
Yeah.
But I know my daughters do. So for me, as an immigrant, I am also revisiting my vernacular with them every now and then, right? So I will take a pause and I'll be like, ah, maybe I should reframe this conversation in a way that resonates with them because they grew up in a different environment. I'm sure you've experienced that with your mother or your parents, both your parents, where they were probably like, ah, maybe this is how we should reframe it so that it resonates with Anita.
Yes. And I think it's so interesting to watch. I live really close to my sister and I'm really close to my niece and nephew, and to watch how they are parenting their kids. Her husband, he's a second generation immigrant. His parents are Indian, and they are trying really hard to build new emotional skills for themselves and for their kids. And I think it is, as you're saying, like a lot of parenting seems to be about like looking back at how you were parented and thinking about what are the things that you want to do differently? What are the things that you want to emulate? And what are the things that are values? Like you felt so loved, you feel so loved by your mom, but is your way of showing that to your kids, does that have to look different because of the context they're growing up in?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go back to your podcast. As I said in the beginning, you've covered so many topics. Some of them are considered taboo in certain communities. How do you decide what topics to pick? And what are some of the cultural considerations you think about when you are having those conversations?
I have a really incredible team. It's small, but it's mighty. And I think we have worked really hard as a show to develop a value system and a way of doing things that feels distinct. And like we feel like when we're inviting a guest to a show, we can be really explicit about the why behind every conversation. And each show starts from a different place. I mean, I think there are so many ways that you get ideas for shows, especially shows in the topics that we talk about, sex, relationships, and health. Like some of them, some ideas come from like a lived experience. Some come from a fiction book that talks about a thing that then I say, oh, like, what would it be like to talk to someone who is an OnlyFans creator, for example? But I think as we kind of narrow down from big picture topic to who are the voices that we want to talk to what's the frame of the conversation, we're thinking a lot about how to center personal narratives, how to ask questions that people want to answer versus just asking questions that an outsider may think are most interesting. And I think that is the hardest part of hosting a show on public radio for me, is finding that balance where we want people who are inside the community that we're talking to feel seen by the show, to not feel like, oh, this is a show to explain this identity marker to people out there. This isn't a show for me. We want to find that overlap where it can be both a show that can invite in other people who don't have that identity experience and feel healing and resonant for people who do. So that is like the intersection point of guests we're often trying to find, is people who can kind of sit at that intersection, who have the lived experience, but who can also talk about it in a way that's accessible. I think a lot of our guests are deeply curious about identity. And I think that's important. As you said, you know, sometimes like there are aspects of our identities that just are like, I don't know, they are it, like it is, like it is because it is. And that's great if that's where you are. But I think for it to work for our show, like you do need to have some level of like you're in a process of curiosity about this aspect of your life or this aspect of your identity. And that's what makes it a fruitful conversation. So I think finding people who are curious and wanting to engage is really important so that people don't feel pigeonholed, so that people don't feel like, I don't know, I think there's a way that conversations about sex and bodies can get voyeuristic. And I think that can come from talking to people who don't want to talk about this particular thing. And so I think that aspect of sourcing is so, so important. And I used to work for a daily show, and I know like it is such a grind to work on a daily show. And it's hard. It's hard to find people like that every day. So you end up going to the just experts who don't necessarily have the lived experience out of necessity. So I think when you're doing a show like ours, like you have to build in time to your process so that you can find people who want to engage in the conversation.
I like that. The other thing that I like about your show is that it has this distinct way of blending vulnerability with journalistic precision, right?
What happens when you fall somewhere in the middle? I've lived this question as a mixed race person and know that it's sometimes a fight to be recognized on the outside the way I feel within. Some folks experience this tension with regard to their gender identity, and for others, their sexuality.
You bring your own vulnerability, guests' vulnerability, but then you're also very aware of where you want that conversation to go ethically and from a journalistic point of view. How do you personally prepare for that?
I think there are a couple of different types of hosts and interviewers in the world. And I err on the side of the over-preparer, probably, because I want to enter the conversation with someone knowing as much as I can so that I can ask questions that get to the second and third step of something and get to that level of depth. So I will read every page of the book. I listen to a lot of interviews of people. And I think throughout the process, I'm working with our producer to kind of think through finding that line between what are the things here where we feel like, okay, from a journalistic responsibility perspective, we have to lay this out X, Y, Z. Where do we need to do that? And where does the guest need to be a part of that conversation is often something that we talk about in the pre-production process of like, okay, for this show, there's a lot of like basic explanation that we need to do for people to understand. Let's not force the guest to do that. Let's do that in our intro copy so that we can then set the guest up for the stronger narrative. We're a very process-oriented show, and we're constantly reworking our process, maybe too often, every month, every few weeks, just because I think we think a lot about what's working and what's not working. As you're saying, like walking that line between the more journalistic aspects of this work and the more personal aspects. It's different with every single show. So it's hard to have like a standard way that you do things when every guest and every topic begs a different set of skills.
Has there been a moment when you shared something on your show about yourself and you instantly regretted it?
Honestly, there is not something that I have shared about myself where I have instantly regretted it. I think I've made assumptions about things other people might want to share and have regretted those. We were doing an episode a couple of years ago, I can't remember when exactly, about abortion and having an abortion and feelings about having abortions and how so many people that have abortions are already mothers themselves. And I reached out to my parents and I asked them if they'd be willing to talk for that episode because I knew, not from an in-depth conversation, but from like an offhanded comment that they had, my mom had an abortion after I was born. She got pregnant again like pretty soon. And I asked if they wanted to have that conversation. My mom said yes. And then we kind of brought her on the line. The mics were rolling and it became very clear that she did not realize that I actually wanted to talk about her decision-making around that. I wasn't talking about, like, intellectually her political opinion on abortion access. I wanted to talk about her personal story. And she was not comfortable sharing that and did not want to go there. And I felt awful for having made the assumption that me stating the topic would mean that she knew that's what we wanted to talk about, and for not having kind of like laid the foundation for that conversation with her in a more empathetic way. So I think that is where I have learned to be much more cautious and careful about seeking permission from people in my life before I talk about something that has to do with them on the show. It can be hard because in a conversation organically, something might come up and I have that quick moment where I think, I'm going to share this and I'm going to hope it's okay. It's been funny. My husband is very gracious, but there have been times where someone has come back to him saying something that related to something I have said on the show. Like, I think we did an episode about vasectomies and I wrote in my intro essay, at the point at which my husband and I either decide not to have kids or we're done, like, he will definitely be getting a vasectomy. And I kind of said that, like, offhanded, like a projection out to the future. But someone, like, I think it was his mom or something, came to him and said, like, I didn't know you were thinking about getting a vasectomy. And he was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, whoops. So it's things like that where I'm like, okay, I need to be, like, a little less casual when I'm just saying these things about other people and their bodies. So those are the moments that come to mind for me.
Do you enjoy being an interviewer more or an interviewee?
Oh, interviewer. Oh, I don't really like being interviewed. She says that she's being interviewed. Much more being an interviewer. I think I'm a very curious person and I grew up, I think I just like, I've always been really curious about how other people live and how other people do what they do. And so it feels like this job in a lot of ways feels like permission to ask the questions that are always rolling around in my head 24/7 all the time. I like talking to other interviewers. I think it's really fun to talk about the craft. And so in that kind of way, I like being interviewed because it feels like a generative conversation for me too. Like I'm learning a lot from you and I really like that. But being on the side of like, I'm here to tell my life story today. Not my favorite thing, no.
Why?
I think I have such a hyperactive brain and I'm always making sense of everything that's happening to me in real time all the time. It's hard for me to get out of my own head and get out of my own way enough, I think, to tell a story or be an interviewee in the way that I would want to be. I'm like too much of a perfectionist, I guess. Like I'm editing myself as I'm talking. And that gets in the way of me just enjoying the experience because I'm already thinking about like, oh, why did you say it that way? Or like, cut that out, like cut out from, you know, 242 to 255. The curse of being the professional, I think, makes it hard for me to just be fully present and enjoy the experience of being interviewed.
Is there a topic that you are just itching to dive into on Embodied?
I would say some of the episodes that we have done in the past few years about the mixed race experience have been really personally meaningful and fruitful for me. And I feel like there is a lot of rich territory to explore there. So I think it's not that we haven't talked about it, but it's like, oh, I feel like we've barely scratched the surface and there's so much more to uncover. I think I love having intergenerational conversations on the show, and I would really like to do more of that, of like people kind of working out their differences and relationships in real time. I think I'm at the age, I'm 36, and a lot of my friends, we're really coming to terms with our parents aging. We're thinking about whether we want to start our own families. And it's such an interesting, I don't know, midlife moment where it feels like there's so many ways our lives could unfold in the next chapter. And so I feel a lot of like personal curiosity about how people work through this phase and all of the different manifestations it can take. So I think, yeah, I'm very interested in like exploring this moment in millennial adulthood and that transition point, but from mostly taking care of yourself to being a caretaker for parents and or kids or both at the same time.
Why podcasting as a tool for storytelling for you?
I think it's the most intimate medium that there is for storytelling. I think, honestly, having an absence of, I know there is a movement toward a lot of podcasts being on video, but to me, there's something so powerful about just an auditory connection with someone,
yeah,
and just hearing someone's voice and letting your mind kind of, it's like what happens when you get and you're reading a really good book and you're in a flow state where you can visualize everything that's happening to the character and you feel connected to them. I think podcasting can do that in a really transformational and transportative way. So to me, it allows you to have that level of like intimacy and connection while giving people the opportunity to build their own relationship to whatever it is you're saying or to you or to the characters in the story. It feels like it can really transport you in a way that other mediums can't.
What are your thoughts on celebrity podcasts?
Too many.
Too many.
Too many. I mean, there are some good ones out there, but I think we're in this age of podcasting where it's like, if you have a name, then inherently people think you need a podcast. And I disagree.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're right. We don't
we
need
do not.
Every celebrity to have a podcast.
We do not. No. So less. Too many. Less.
Too many. Absolutely. And in the end, Anita, if you were to define the United States of America in the context of creating space for mixed race identities, how would you do that?
Whew. I think the first word that comes to mind to me is like unmasking. And I think there's a lot about, as we've talked about in this conversation, there's a lot about narratives around race and identity in the West that are lacking in depth and lacking in real reckoning with history, real reckoning with difference. And so I think unmasking to me means like peeling back the layers of how you present to the world and how the world sees you, which may be different. How I think a big part of my journey as a mixed person has been trying to figure out what it means that people might not read me externally the way that I feel on the inside. And so pulling back those layers of what does it mean for me to feel more connected to that? Why does it matter that other people don't read me that way? How do I find my own sense of belonging no matter how other people respond to me? And then how do I actually like learn a lot about my own history? I think that in the past few years, I've been having more conversations with my parents and my brothers-in-laws, or just listening to their stories of growing up in India when they did, experiences of partition, narratives around migration and immigration. And I think it's important as mixed kids to really learn those histories and learn those stories and carry them with us.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the unmasking is also like figuring out who your parents are behind maybe the masks that they have put on to raise you in this country and hold space for them to do that work as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And to judge them less.
Yes.
As an immigrant parent.
Yes.
I really want people to judge us less.
Yes.
Well, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Anita. Where can people find your podcast?
Yes, you can find Embodied wherever you get your podcasts. Embodiedwunc.org is our website, and we're on Instagram and TikTok and all of the social media places as well. Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
You know what? I don't like New Year resolutions. but I will make one anyways. I am going to share more of my thoughts with all of you, what I'm experiencing, what I'm doing that week. For instance, in this episode, I talked about a random song, and I'm going to continue doing that. I'm going to continue to be more honest, vulnerable, and hope that you and I can get to know each other better. I love this conversation with Anita. There was so much more to unpack, but you know what? I feel we ended it on a great note. This episode was produced and written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week and I have another guest.